Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago. And it's always going to be hard to top a show with David Gans like we had last week. But this being the Deadhead Cannabis Show, there's never a shortage of stuff for us to talk about. And the three of us, that being myself and my two co-hosts, Rob Hunt and Jim Marty, have a whole list of things to talk with you guys about today. Some new action on federal legalization, as well as a bunch of stuff in Grateful Dead history that all happened right around this time of year and is worth mentioning, as well as a quick shout-out to the memory of Bob Matthews of the Grateful Dead family who passed away recently, and we haven't had a chance to talk about that yet. But diving in really quickly, let's say hi to everyone. Jim Marty, how are you doing today?
Very good. Very good as we turn to fall here. As I think it was in a song sometime, summertime gonna come and go. My oh my. Seems like just a few weeks ago we were out there in our t-shirts enjoying Phil and friends, and now we're getting a dusting of snow in the mountains here.
Okay, it's that time of year. And looks like he's back in California and living life down there the good way. Rob Hunt, how are you, Rob?
I'm great. I'm in the land where we never get dustings of snow in San Diego, so it stays summer all year long. So despite what U.S. Blues may say, it's summertime, stay and stay, my oh my. All's good. Looking forward to another fun episode today.
Fantastic. Well, let's dive right in, and let's swing right back to Rob, because we are going to talk today about the Hall of Flowers. Rob, if you could give our listeners, those who may not know what the Hall of Flowers is, a quick background on it, and tell us how this year's show went.
So, first of all, I didn't go to it this year, but I will say that everything I've heard from the people that attended is that, you know, these guys once again just delivered. The team that puts on Hall of Flowers puts on such a unique event in cannabis, and anyone that hasn't gone to it should absolutely make it a mission to at least try to attend at some point. It's really like a one-of-a-kind industry event where it's a true business-to-business show where it's designed to really, you know, make brands and retailers get to know each other, get to understand the product mix, really see products instead of see, like, you know, what people want to put in front of, like, their MJ Biz style booth. This is a booth, you know, that people have where you go there, you purchase, you use, you consume, you trade tips, you trade, you know, war stories, what's happening in the trenches. But it's a totally different style, you know, vibe, where it's really like there's no suits at the show. It's really just the guys that they're in the trenches making your products. So every year in Santa Rosa, they do it in the fall. They usually, you know, time it right around harvest season. But Hall of Flowers, you know, again, just finished up a couple days ago. And by all accounts, it was just absolutely fantastic. Have you either of you guys made it out there? Or not yet, huh?
No, but from what you're saying, I think I should look into it.
As do I. I've never been to Hall of Flowers, but I would love to get out there. Just the way you make it sound, Rob, it's making me wonder why I haven't been there three times already. So come next year, I'm going to try and rectify that. And maybe we can even tape an episode from Santa Rosa.
Yeah, that'd be super cool. You know, for everyone out there, take a look at hallflowers.com. There's some great images on their gallery. There's a lot of information about the show. So definitely love to plug the guys that are doing cool things in the industry, and those guys are definitely doing something that's really special. So definitely give them a check out.
Okay, very good. So the Hall of Flowers in Santa Rosa is the place to be, and give us something to look forward to report on next year. Thank you for that, Jim. Right before the show started, you were giving us a quick rundown a little bit on what's going on with the status of the Safe Banking Act and new ways in which Congress seems determined to try and get it passed.
Yes, surprised to have an article cross my desk a couple weeks ago that the Congress had passed on a voice vote, and it was attached to a Department of Defense funding bill. So the old saying is politics make strange bedfellows, and certainly that's true in this case. So we'll take it any way we can get it. The same article did say it has an uphill fight in the Senate, but we shall see. You know, Kamala Harris could break a vote. I'm not sure if this is one of these that needs 60 votes or not, or a simple majority, but we'll see what happens. I think the bigger question for me, as an accountant with lots of clients in the cannabis industry, is what does it really mean? And got to go over that with some top-notch lawyers at Vicente Cederberg. And what it doesn't mean is that we'd get merchant services. So still no MasterCard Visa will come out of this, but it does open the door for more banks and some of your big players to come into the industry and offer checking accounts and perhaps mortgages on cannabis cultivation or retail. So it definitely is a step in the right direction, but it doesn't fix everything, like I said, such as merchant services, MasterCard, Visa, American Express. Still not going to be welcome at your local dispensary.
So the government's, federal government's apparently still cool on huge wads of cash being stashed in mattresses, but there's not much we can do about that. However, it's interesting what you said, because one of the stories that I read suggested that Schumacher and some of the others who are, you know, trying to get their own bills passed aren't as excited to have this kind of passed piecemeal, and they'd rather have it passed as one, as part of one comprehensive bit of cannabis legalization. On the other hand, Jim, you know, in deference to some of the things that we've all talked about on this show about some of the maybe unexpected and unintended or unexpected consequences of legalization on a national level, is if this allows people to at least get their banking accounts and solve some problems without completely opening the door to everybody else, that might be a very good first step.
Yeah, anything's a step in the right direction. If you wait for that perfect bill, you may never get anything done.
Right, exactly.
So stay tuned. Pay attention to Congress in these, you know, very turbulent political times that we're living through. It'd be nice to see something positive happen.
It would. Although Rob raised a very interesting point, and I'll let him expound on it maybe here in a minute. But, you know, if this is part of the National Defense Authorization Act, I'm going to admit that in my 30-second Google search, I could not get a definitive enough answer on it as to whether this is an annual type of bill, meaning that if the Safe Banking Act is tied to the NDAA, does that only make it effective for 1 year until the next authorization bill comes around? Or once it's passed, is it passed and in there all the way? Rob, what do you think about that?
Yeah, again, you know, I haven't followed this as closely as I followed the previous passage of the SAFE Act when it came out of the House, because it's now the fifth time it's passed and it's failed in the Senate the last four times. So I haven't really held my breath if this one's any different. What I will say is that anytime you put a piece of legislation as a rider onto a must-pass piece of legislation, such as, you know, either the Defense Spending Act or the omnibus budget package, you know, usually it gets through because you know, the Senate's got no other choice but to pass it. But usually when it's done that way, it means that it only lasts as long as the Authorization Act lasts, and if it needs to be passed again, it's passed again, which is what we see every year with what used to be called the Rombacher-Farr Amendment and then the Rombacher-Blumenauer Amendment. Now I think it's just called the Blumenauer Amendment. So with that one, even though it passes every year, it's passed, I think, 10 years running at this point, and every year with, you know, massive bipartisan support, but that's because it's tacked on as a rider to the omnibus spending package or the omnibus budget. So with that, it's fine. On that specific bill, it's not a big deal because it just gives protections on an annual basis to anyone that operates within the medicinal cannabis arena. This one's different because this one's asking banks to change their behavior. And, you know, to get Bank of America and Wells and Chase and B of A, or, you know, JPM to actually change what their policy is going to be on a long-term basis, you have to give them more than just 1 year of comfort. If you say to them, like, look, this is only good until next year, they run that up their flagpole to compliance. Compliance is going to come back and go, guys, we're not changing a global policy on a one-year, you know, piece of legislation. We have no idea if it's going to pass next year. So until we actually have, like, real comfort that this thing is, you know, passing for the long term, and that's why I think I've yet to see an article that can definitively say one way or the other, I'd be worried about the passage of this anyway, of whether or not it even really means anything outside of just a symbolic victory in Congress and the Senate to say we got banking passed, but, you know, it's not going to change the attitude of the big boys in the process.
Yes, and to, you know, Larry's comment about, you know, mattresses stuffed with cash, actually, you know, we're 10 years ago that was true, but a lot of credit unions are accepting cannabis clients. You know, our company gets paid 99%, 99.9% with checks these days. So the local credit unions are jumping into this space and filling it out. It is expensive to have a checking account in the cannabis industry, you know, $1,000, $3,000, $5,000 a month, depending on your volume. The issue there is that if a credit union does decide to get into this industry, they've got to build their own internal compliance department, and it's very expensive for them. So they're just passing along the cost of compliance onto their customers. So that's where we're at with banking. You know, Bridge West and Vicente Cederberg today did a an hour-long webinar on it, which the links to that can be found at our BridgeWest website if anybody wants more details on the current state of banking, lending, and investing in the cannabis industry.
Yeah, and again, that's kind of a distinction without a difference as far as, you know, the way the banking is working right now, because there are enough financial institutions that are banking cannabis clients. So it's not really a question of whether or not you've got access to a bank account these days. Anyone that's relatively savvy in the cannabis space should be able to get a bank. The bigger question is access to leverage. And that's where, you know, I'm really waiting to see whether or not banks start lending. And if they start lending, they start lending at like LIBOR plus instead of at, you know, 12 to 15% coupons that we're seeing right now with private lending. That's going to make a huge difference in the growth of the industry, because there's nobody right now that's got access to really cheap capital. Even the biggest guys, you know, even the GTIs of the world, when they raise money at 7% coupon, that was considered to be the cheapest capital we've ever seen. But that's still, you know, 5.5% above prime. So, you know, that's where we're waiting to see whether or not the banking changes and whether or not the Safe Banking Act is going to make a major impact.
Yes, very good points, Rob. We're hoping to close on a first mortgage on it for a cultivation on the East Coast here from a bank at right at what you were talking about, 7%. So we'll see if that happens. We got a commitment letter went out this week, so we're on it. But outside of first mortgages, which are with full personal guarantees on that first mortgage, we're not seeing a lot of lending.
Okay, so like everything else on the federal level, we'll take a step back and wait and see how it plays itself out and be prepared to talk about it when it happens. One other thing of note, it looks like stories are coming out that the state of Pennsylvania might soon be looking at a proposal to join the ranks of those states that have added an adult use component to their marijuana program. They currently have a medical program in Pennsylvania, but nothing adult use wise yet, even though New York State is now on board. I believe New Jersey is now on board. So that's not really my part of the world, but I'll defer to Rob in terms of you know, what that means for the East Coast market if Pennsylvania does in fact come on board with adult use.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've had 3 years now of John Fetterman and Governor Wolf saying that they're, you know, making this a major portion of their policy and what they ran on. And I think that Fetterman is absolutely one of the biggest proponents of legalization of cannabis. So it doesn't surprise me, but this isn't coming out of the governor's mansion. This is actually coming out of the state legislature. So they've put bills forward before. They haven't really done too much, so we're not sure what's going to happen this time. But there's more and more support when you think that, you know, already their neighbor to the north in New Jersey is going to have adult use legalized cannabis. Hochman now in New York is certainly, you know, progressing where Cuomo kind of left off. You know, it's one more step in kind of the link of like just dominoes falling in New England. So it's been expected for a while that Pennsylvania is going to move. But if it does, I mean, look, that's a 10 million person state. That's, you know, one of the eight biggest states in America in terms of population. So if you go to adult use, you know, that's not a really huge, robust medicinal program that's there yet. So, you know, sometimes when medicinal goes to adult use recreational, you don't see a huge pop such as Arizona, which already had, you know, very expansive medicinal law. Other times, you know, if the law hasn't been in place very long, like let's say Nevada, you can see a 4x jump in sales between medicinal and adult use. My guess is Pennsylvania would be more like a 6x jump, simply because they just don't have, you know, that many years of history in medicinal, and you've got such a huge population of potential users, or, you know, total addressable market, as we like to say. So, you know, the expectation is that Pennsylvania is going to make a real impact, and I'd put that market at somewhere around $3.5 to $4 billion a year in retail once it's fully operational.
Yes, we do some work in Pennsylvania. A couple of comments is the legislatures, you know, they know if it goes to a ballot issue that it's going to pass. So, you know, they get out in front of it by crafting the legislation that they want in their state house. So it is interesting to see more and more of these adult use initiatives coming out of state houses and not ballot initiatives. One point. The other is, yeah, the medical program in Pennsylvania has been very successful on the cultivation side. There are some enormous cultivation sites in Pennsylvania. I'm talking 250,000 square feet. So if and when they do get medical, they won't have the same problems that Massachusetts has, per se, of not enough product. I think they'll have enough cultivators built into the medical program that they'll be able to supply the adult use too. So that's my two bits on Pennsylvania.
Very good. Like everything else, we'll see what happens there, but I think there's always room in the market for another state, and a state like Pennsylvania to generate those kind of returns would be very impressive, and also a big boost for the market. So with all this going on the marijuana side, we could certainly keep talking forever, but there's just as much on the Grateful Dead side, and I think that we would be remiss if we don't pivot right now and dive into some of it, because it turns out this is really a very fruitful time for the Grateful Dead and their fans. Those of us old enough to remember, and you may not be one of them, Rob, back when we were touring in the early 80s, this was always the time of year when we were on the road and checking things out on the East Coast. But so much has gone on, and we're going to dive right into it as soon as we take a moment, I think, to really honor and pay tribute to a big member of the family who passed away just a couple of weeks ago, Bob Matthews, one of the original sound engineers for the band, and a guy who, along with Betty Cantor, are generally acknowledged probably to be, you know, two of the best sound people ever to work in the industry, let alone with the Grateful Dead. But Bob was there at the very beginning. He knew Bob Weir back from high school days, and was involved with Mother McCree's and up through the Warlocks and into the Grateful Dead. The Garcia family tweet after they announced Matthew's passing was that without Bob, Live Dead, the album Garcia, Europe 72, Skull and Roses, and Working Man's Dead might not ever really have come into being, or at least not the way that we know them. One excellent example on that was shared this past Sunday by our new friend of the show, David Gans, of Tales from the Golden Road on the Sirius Deadhead station. And he was telling us about an interview that he had heard with Bob Matthews a few years back, and they played it. And Bob Matthews is like a kid in a candy store explaining how the studio that they went to at the time to record in the San Francisco area had a Studio D that was all the way in the back, and nobody ever wanted to go into Studio D to record. Everybody wanted to be in A and B, which was right up front. But he and Garcia and Kreutzmann went back into Studio D when Garcia was getting ready to start recording the Garcia album and was still fiddling around with some of the tunes. And he said they went in there and they got everything all set up. And at one point, Garcia walked over and sat down and started playing the piano. And he said, you know, this room wasn't very big, so the piano was literally right up against the drums. And he was noodling on the piano, and Kreutzmann was noodling on the drums. And, you know, after a couple of minutes, they found this groove that they really played, and they really played out, and it ultimately became the foundation for The Wheel. And they played it, and when they were done, Matthew says that Garcia turned around to him and said, "Bob, tell me you were recording that." And Matthew's response was, "You know, damn, Jerry, you don't know me well enough to know. Of course I was recording that." And so he said they were immediately able to take that and sit down and work through it, and Hunter came up with the words in a matter of hours, and within a day or two, you know, they pretty much had the polished tune ready to go. You know, but he talked about all the different little things that went into the tune and on the album, the very intricate introduction into the tune with all sorts of little background sounds and noises that lead into it and that ultimately kind of dissolve into the opening riffs of the song. But it was fascinating to hear, you know, these types of stories and examples from the guys who were there when the songs were created and when the songs were being created, you know, being put together and recorded and played live for the first couple of times. And, you know, where would the Deadhead world be without Live Dead or Europe 72, for that matter, or any of these albums? So, you know, I don't think, you know, he probably doesn't get enough credit, Bob Matthews, but, you know, he can't get enough. And anytime you ever saw anything that said sound by, you know, Bob and Betty, you were always knew you were going to be in pretty good shape. Jim, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, he'll be missed for sure. And, you know, I was a sophomore in high school when that album came out. So I remember seeing in the LP format, and it was like your friends were saying, "You've got to listen to this album. You've got to listen to this album. This is the best album." And yeah, it's got The Wheel on it. It's got Deal on it. It's got so many what became classic Grateful Dead songs. I think I mentioned this on a prior broadcast, but I heard the story that Jerry, Mountain Girl, was pregnant with one of their first children, I believe, and Jerry had to buy a house for them. And that's when he went into the studio to record that album so he'd have the money to buy his first house. And he called it, yeah, that album was all about wheeling and dealing.
Very good. Rob, any thoughts on Bob Matthews?
No, just, you know, that I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, how early he was. He was actually a member of Mother McCree's Uptown Jug Champions. So that predates the Warlocks. So if you think about, you know, kind of like what became, you know, the Grateful Dead before there was the Grateful Dead, before there was the Warlocks, there was Mother McCree's, and Bob was actually in that band. But, you know, to be considered their first roadie and their first sound engineer, you know, that's someone that goes back as far as anyone does with that band. So, you know, just a little bit sad knowing that they're of that age where it's not uncommon now that we're losing someone, you know, relatively, you know, I wouldn't say frequently, but far more often than we'd like. So, you know, hopefully everyone else can stay around a bit longer, make some more great music for us, and, you know, put together some more great stories for us.
Yeah. How old was he when he passed?
I don't know, but he had to be in his 70s at least. He's the same age as Bobby, I think. And I think Bobby's in his mid-70s now. Yeah.
Mid-70s.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah. He definitely, you know, been around for a while, but that's, you know, I think what makes it so amazing is, you know, the stories are, you know, he went back to high school with Bobby and, you know, they talked, interviewed, Gans and Gary Lambert the other day interviewed a woman, I can't remember her name, who went to high school with them. And she talked about the early days when they would all, after high school, gather at one of their houses so that they could practice for what became Mother McCree's and all of that. And I just thinking, you know, we never had anything exciting like that going on at my house after school, but I guess you just have to be in the right place at the right time. But yeah, Bob Matthews is definitely someone who will be missed. And I would say to newer and younger Deadheads, if you're not really following this conversation entirely, you should really make it a point to read up on Bob and go back and listen to some of these albums that we're talking about, which really form, in, you know, in my opinion, the basis of, you know, who the Grateful Dead are and what they're all about. And you're doing yourself a disservice as a Deadhead not to know who Bob Matthews is and the role that he and Betty Cantor played in helping the Grateful Dead create their sound.
Yes, and if you can get it in the LP format, to enjoy the beautiful artwork on the cover of that first Garcia solo album.
Yes, that's true. That's, I mean, I'm always a fan of the vinyl for the cover art, but that's a good one as well. So,
speaking of getting on, I happened to see some of the Phil Lesh shows here in Colorado a couple weeks ago. Nice brand new venue right on Dillon Reservoir, which is a large reservoir up in the mountains above Denver. It actually supplies Denver's water supply. They built this venue a couple years ago, and then, of course, nothing went on in 2020 because of COVID, and it's open now. And yeah, beautiful little amphitheater. It's kind of like a mini Red Rocks. It holds about 3,500 people. Very low key, no security to get in. Just walk right in and scan your ticket. Nice big pit in front of the stage for dancing. And a very nice feature is if you're down low and you are on the dance floor in the pit, they have bathrooms built into the side of the stage, so you don't have to hike all the way up to the top of the stairs. But great shows, Broke Down Palace for an encore. I was really impressed with Graham Lesh. He has a beautiful voice. I had never seen him live before. And he guess what? He knows all the words. So great shows. And then Vail the next night, which we missed. And then Saturday was Lyons, Colorado, 5 miles from my house. I personally didn't get there because I had a wedding I attended, but our son Jack and a big crew of his 10 friends all piled into my Suburban and drove the 5 miles from my house over to Lyons, Colorado, where they got an Uncle John's band. They got a Eyes of the World that went on forever. They got a something. What's that song? Marbles? Something? Marbles?
King Solomon's Marbles?
Yes. That was the encore. King Solomon's Marbles into Touch of Grey for the encore.
From Blues of Frawley. Yeah, Phil plays that.
Well, they had, I guess on Saturday night, she stole the show. Holly Bowling was on keyboards. And I've got a great Holly Bowling story. And so, yeah, I was up at Dillon, very intimate. I mean, we could touch the stage. So she's a great keyboard player. She tours on her own with a grand piano. She's a classic pianist. And she always wears her signature little baseball hat, like. And so she comes out on stage at Dillon, and I'm yelling, "Hey, Holly! Hey, Holly!" I'm trying to get her attention because I actually met her after a Phish show on Shakedown Street after a Phish show at Dick's a couple years ago. And I recognized her because of her signature cap that she always wears. And we stopped, and she chatted. I said, "Hey, how are you liking the Phish show?" She goes, "Oh," a classic line she tells me, "Trey will be Trey," she said. So I actually got to meet her a couple years ago. So I'm up at Dillon. I'm 20 yards away from her or less. And hey, Holly, I'm trying to catch her eye. And I didn't. But then some guy comes over to me. He goes, "How do you know Holly Bowling?" So I told him the story of how I had met her at Shakedown Street after a Phish show. And he goes, yeah, I'm torn with her. My best friend is her boyfriend, and we're torn with her. So, yeah, that's really cool that you got to know Holly Bowling. So that's my Holly Bowling story. But I guess she stole the show on Saturday night. I guess she just tore it up. But, yeah, Phil looks good, 81 years old, very thin, but he seems to have a good energy level. He was dancing. He sang. His voice was very strong, singing, of course, with Graham and backing him up. And I forget the fellow's name, a local Denver musician, Berkeley-trained guitar player, played lead. And Graham was so cool. He actually kind of imitates Bobby's style. So when the guy doing lead was stretching out, he was like filling in the middle the way Bob Weir does. So wonderful Phil shows, and now he is off to the New York City to a big run of shows at the Capitol Theater.
Correct, and I will be there October 11th, 12th, and 13th, which are the first three nights of that nine-night run. And for those three nights, it will be the quintet. He'll be playing with Warren Haynes, Jimmy Herring, John Molo, and Rob Baracco on the keyboards. And I love that collection of musicians. Any one of them alone is great. And to hear all of them together for me is about as good as it gets. And really brings out the best in Phil. And with Warren Haynes on the scene, he can sing a lot more than Phil, which is even better. I have no idea where Graham Lesh got his voice from, but it certainly wasn't from his father, with all due respect to Phil, who we love. So I'm very excited to see those Phil shows, and I'll be reporting back after those. We did have a couple of Dead & Company shows here a few weeks ago at Wrigley Field, which were very, very good shows. And, as I tell anyone, on any given night, who doesn't want to go out to Wrigley Field with, 39 or 40,000 of your, nearest and dearest Deadhead buddies and just sit around and, and watch the guys who wrote it all perform it. And while it can be a little frustrating sometimes to see the way Bob kind of reinvents Jerry's tunes, and I just have to say, we talked about this a little bit with David Gans last week, but I'm listening to all of these Bobby tunes when I'm driving around that he just never is playing. When was the last time they played I Need a Miracle? I just don't remember. When was the last time they played My Brother Esau? When was the last time they played Victim or the Crime? When was the last time they played any of these Bobby tunes? And they're his songs. I'd like to hear his songs a lot more, but we got what we got. It was all good. And another run with Dead & Company. So that was fun as well.
Well, as we mentioned, we have a four-night run of Dead & Company coming up here in Colorado with two shows at Red Rocks and then two at Fiddler's Green. But, Rob, you got to see Trey recently with the Trey Anastasio Band up in Boston. How was that?
It was great. It was a full reunion of a bunch of old friends I hadn't seen in a long time that all happened to converge on a venue for a night. So if nothing else, there could have been nothing playing. It would have been a great night. It just happened that the accompanying band was Tab, and it was fantastic. The sand that night was amazing. Most of what they played was super tight, so it was really fun. But it was for me more fun to be outside on a Boston summer night next to the water at a venue that I've told you guys about before called the Bank of America Pavilion. So really fun. Trey is definitely at the top of his game. Jennifer Hartswick, as always, kind of stole the show for parts of it. There was a father-daughter trombone team that was just absolutely crushing. So, it's one of the things I love about Tab, and I love about a lot of bands. And any band that has a horn section, I'm usually okay with. And Tab certainly has got one of the best ones in the business. So it was a lot of fun.
Right. Jennifer is the trumpet player, correct?
She is. And when I lived in Burlington, I'd go see her every Wednesday night at a little bar called Red Square. So I've been seeing Hartswick play for a long, long time, and it's great that she has such a huge audience now of Fish fans that, really follow what she does professionally, because it used to be just kind of a local musician that played around Burlington, who now just has a great national following.
Huh. And is that how she met Trey? Was back in Burlington?
It was. It's a lot of the people that play in that band, had their Burlington roots, and that's true of a lot of the other horn players that used to play in the Giant Country Horns that played with Fish, back in the summer of 91, and then since then on a bunch of other tours like Dave Grippo and Carl Gearshart and Russ Remington. Those were all touring musicians from Burlington as well.
Well, I certainly agree with you that Trey is on top of his game. His guitar was blazing at Dick's on Labor Day weekend, and we got the fall tour coming up. They're going to start out in Sacramento and finish up in Las Vegas, so it's all West Coast. I've heard some good things about the venue they're going to play in Sacramento, that it has big garage doors that can open and get some good air going through there. Rob, what do you know about that venue?
Very little, actually. I don't know very much about it at all.
Yeah. I guess it's the first time Fish has played Sacramento in about 25 years.
Well, although they just played Shoreline, right? So, I mean, and they were going to play Reno, so they're in the general area.
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say is, you know, Tahoe for the last 10 years has really been their spot. So it doesn't surprise me Sacramento's taking a backseat to playing Tahoe.
Mm-hmm. Well, a comment I would make is, you know, Trey is actually following in Jerry's footsteps in a very substantial way in that, you know, one of the reasons for the Jerry Garcia Band and, you know, and the corollary is to the Trey Anastasio Band is Jerry would say, hey, if... The Grateful Dead are not going to play for 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. I'm going to lose my chops. And so that's what was one of his founding principles of the Jerry Garcia Band, is playing those smaller venues. He liked playing in the bars because he got paid in cash, and we all know where that went. But but similar now, Trey, you know, when Fish has 2 or 3 or 4 weeks off, he's back out playing, you know, not losing his chops, staying on top of his game by playing with the Trey Anastasio Band. So very interesting how similar those two people are in so many ways.
Yeah, certainly. Both very devoted to their craft, no question about it. Two other topics that we really have to cover. One, I know, is something that Rob had talked about, and we all know about it to some degree as well. Anyone who's ever listened to the Grateful Dead albums, Reckoning or Dead Set, which for a lot of people, including me, were the first really live Dead music I was exposed to, even before Live Dead. That was kind of my album entry into the Grateful Dead, was listening to those albums and getting a feel for what they sounded like live. But those albums pulled all of their music from two historic runs, one at the Warfield Theater in San Francisco, followed by one a little bit later in October at Radio City Music Hall. In New York, there's been films made of them and all sorts of tapes, and of course the two albums we just mentioned. That was 41 years ago.
41, but that's right. But it was a combination of Radio City and the Warfield, and the run that just started was actually the Warfield in San Francisco. But that was in 1980. They did a really unique format where they played one set of acoustic and then would come back out and play two sets of electric. So you really got to see everything they were doing, and there's a lot of songs they never played electric that they would play acoustic that were always a lot of fun to listen to. So obviously they threw some electric songs in that they played acoustic instead, like a Ripple or a Bird song, but a lot of songs were just Grateful Dead songs that they played on the as an acoustic ensemble. So really unique, and I never got to see the Grateful Dead play acoustic. I got to see Garcia Band play acoustic a handful of times, or with Garcia Grisman, which is always amazing to see Jerry play an acoustic guitar. But to have those runs of, you know, however many shows between the East Coast and the West Coast, where you got, you know, just a handful of really terrific stuff that I think all of us as fans probably spent years of our life listening to those acoustic tapes.
And I think we have a little bit to listen to, which is not what I recently listened to out of my barn. I recently checked out the video of Ripple from that run. But what are we going to listen to today?
I think as far as the acoustic, maybe we'll play a little bit of the Monkey and the Engineer, just because it really gives a great sense of kind of Garcia's picking and kind of the playful picking that he would do during that song. So after, you know, two relatively like humorous and playful verses, you had a really nice, you know, Garcia solo that was just pure Jerry on the acoustic. So let's listen to that for a quick second. Really, really fun stuff.
It is. And I think they really enjoyed those shows. My guess is they probably loved to do acoustic shows. It was, you know, very nice for them, a little more intimate. And I love the pictures of, you know, the drummers just kind of sitting there, each with a snare drum and a little flare type of drumstick. But as I recall, I always remember Phil still holding an electric bass. I could be wrong about that, but I think that Phil was always still kind of on the electric bass as the rest of them segued over into, but they'd sit around in a circle and they'd play the tunes. And yeah, that's fantastic stuff. And those are fun tunes, especially Monkey and the Engineer. I really like that song a lot. I used to sing that to my kids when they were little.
And yes. And the video of Ripple, Phil was plugged in for sure. So, yeah, one interesting story I read recently in one of my many, many Grateful Dead books is that although Jerry did like the acoustic, he hated playing solo. So he very rarely played solo. He liked to have John Kahn or somebody else on a stand-up acoustic bass if he was going to do an acoustic set. But he really did not like playing solo at all. Very interesting. I didn't know that until I came across that in a book recently.
No, I'd never heard that either. But
think about it. How many times have you seen him solo on stage?
I never, that I can recall. You know, he was always with one version of a band or another, I think. So I...
The story I heard is that after one set solo acoustic, he came off the stage and he yelled, "Get me John Kahn!" And they said, "John Kahn's on the West Coast. You're in New York. We can't do that."
They sent a plane for him and brought him back, I bet. You know, the other thing about Warfield and Radio City Music Hall shows that I really love, especially Radio City Music Hall, I just remember looking at all the pictures of, you know, the Deadheads who were camping out along... right outside the entrance of Radio City Music Hall and all down the street, you know, for like a block or two or three, you know, deep off the wall of the building. And, you know, for basically about a week and a half, they just held court there as the Dead played their sets. I'm sure they had a similar scene out in San Francisco near the Warfield as well. But, you know, that's kind of fun that, you know, they put up big fancy signs over the entrances to both of the theaters and really, certainly in the case of the Warfield, you know, really kind of turned them into almost like little Dead museums and places to just go and learn about the Dead. And I will just give a quick shout out to a friend of the show, Jay Blakesburg, Dead photographer, who's been kind enough to be on two episodes with us. Who, as I say, posted this, and he's got a really great photo if you find his post on Instagram. And, you know, it makes you realize just how long ago this really was. It's a picture of Garcia on stage, and it's striking. It's just striking to see how thin he is, even in 1980. I felt by the time I started seeing them in 82, you know, that he was already a pretty heavy guy, and certainly by the end, he was very heavy. But this is just a great photo of him. I mean, he looks healthy. He looks thin. He's wearing a Mars Hotel shirt. And, you know, he's clearly having a good time. So if you have a chance to check out Jay's post on Instagram, I would do that as well. And anytime Jay posts anything, it's always well worth seeing. Any other thoughts on that, Rob?
Just, I think it's worth going back and listening to all those acoustic shows. You know, you got songs that you never heard otherwise, as I said, you know, and you even got some Bobby Weir tunes like Heaven Help the Fools being played during that period. But you had like I've Been All Around This World and Dark Hollow and like Dire Wolves, all of them being played acoustic. So, you know, because we're airing the show on October the 3rd, you know, that was the show from the Warfield that we picked to kind of feature today. But there's some great stuff there. And the other cool thing about it is if you have listened to Reckoning or you have listened to Dead Set, you know, every song from those was taken from, you know, one of those nights. So you kind of have to go back and look at the track listing and see which night it was recorded and then go back and mix and match because there was a handful of different things that were pulled for both. And, you know, much in the same vein that they did the shows in, you know, the Reckoning was basically one long acoustic set and Dead Set was, you know, two full live sets. So, you know, really cool. And if you remember, you know, talking about album art, if you remember that one, what made that album art was so amazing is you'd open up the double disc and it was the Golden Gate Bridge essentially connecting to the Brooklyn Bridge with kind of like Grateful Dead world in between, which was always a really cool idea of bridging East and West with Grateful Dead fans and the venues they played in to make those albums.
Absolutely. That is classic Grateful Dead cover art. And like I say, those albums were, you know, in many respects, my first true introduction to the Grateful Dead. I had listened to American Beauty and Working Man's and a lot of that other stuff. But, you know, these really allowed me for the first time to really kind of capture the true feel of live Dead. I hadn't been introduced to Skull and Roses yet. I knew about Europe 72, but these were just great, you know, and I love the acoustic. And I think that as much as anything pulled me into this band that, you know, they just were, had that broad a scope of what they could do and play and sound good doing it. You know, and those acoustic songs hold up so well years later. It's just a real pleasure to listen to it.
Yeah, Dead Set and what was the acoustic one? Reckoning. Both, you know, big part of my world in the early 1980s. Out of college, setting up my first expensive stereo, listening to those albums over and over, and they're still classics.
Always good stuff.
I think those were some of the first albums they played on Arista. So that was, you know, the Clive Davis years. So if you think back to, you know, we used to play for silver, now we play for Clive. You know, it was the sort of transition from old record company to being really heavily recruited by Arista and Clive Davis. So if anyone knows the history of Clive, who was just one of the most legendary guys in the music industry, if you were on his roster, it's because he really wanted you on that roster and he treated you like gold. So by all accounts, that was a huge transition for the band, and then putting out a couple extra albums for Clive at that time to fulfill some record obligations. You know, boy, are we lucky that, that's the way it happened.
Right. And then I don't remember the video that they made with Franken and Davis, which one that was, but there's a video out there with Franken and Davis as the hosts during this whole set of shows. And all I remember is at the beginning, Brent is still new with the band and they can't get any of the band members to talk to them, so except for Brent. So they ask Brent if he'll introduce them. So he walks out on stage and says, "I don't know who these guys are and I don't think they're very funny. But, you know, here's Franken and Davis." And then, you know, they get on and they do their shtick. And then, of course, the Dead come out and play. But it's a fun video to watch. So if you ever have a chance, you should go back and check that out, too. One other thing in Dead World that we wanted to talk about today, and it's amazing, guys, how even when we don't have a guest and we don't really have a lot to talk about, we always have so much to talk about. 54 years ago, last week, on September 29th, 1967, the Grateful Dead played a show that they played apparently under the name of the Straight Theater Dance Troupe, because they were trying to hide who they really were for reasons that I still don't really quite understand. But it was a kind of a running joke. And the second set of this show is famous because it is the first time that Mickey Hart played with the band live on stage. The story behind this is that Mickey was at the show. And I'm not exactly familiar with the hows and whys of how he knew Bill Kreutzmann, but Bill Kreutzmann invited him to come out and play drums with him for the second set of that show. It wasn't a particularly long show in terms of, well, set lists and things like that. The first set was Dancing in the Streets, A Friend of Mine, Golden Road, and New Potato Caboose. But then for set two, when Mickey came out, the band promptly launched into an hour-and-a-half version of Alligator, which then spilled over into Caution, and that was it for the night. So Mickey's first run with the Dead was one set, two songs, and almost 2 hours of music, which is pretty much par for the course with these guys. And just in case Mickey was wondering who he was jamming with, he found out pretty quickly. The interesting thing is it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to find a recording of this show on YouTube. I did find a few clips of it, but not even full songs. It's written up a lot, primarily because of it being Mickey's first show. If you ever get your hands on any of it, though, it's music I would certainly love to listen to. And of course, for the history of the band, it really kind of changed their course in a way that up to that point maybe wasn't quite as common and still isn't all that common, by adding a second drummer you know, to a live performance. And Mickey and Billy really hit it off, and you know, 54 years later, here we are still going out and listening to them do their drum circle at the intermission, and it's as good as ever. Jim?
Well, the way I heard that story, read about it, is that at set break, Billy and Mickey jumped in Billy's car and went back to Mickey's place and gathered up his drums and brought him back for the second set.
Oh, okay. Well, that's even better. I like that.
A little more detail that I heard. And that would have been interesting to say about the recording, because 67, Bear would have been in the sound booth, and Bear was meticulous about recording every show. So there should be full show recordings of that. So now that's a homework assignment for our listeners. Let us know if you find a full recording of that show recorded by Stanley Owsley Bear.
Okay. Yeah, very good. But it's just, you know, another one of those moments in Grateful Dead history that's too significant to let slide by without acknowledging for those in the group who wonder, you know, where Mickey came from and how he got on the bus, and there it all was.
Well, to answer the other question, the way he met Bill Kreutzmann was actually, Mickey was working at a drum shop and was introduced by Count Basie's drummer, a guy named Sonny Payne. So that was the introduction, and then they became friends soon after that, and Billy invited Mickey up to that show. So it was technically through Count Basie, who came into the drum shop Mickey was working in.
Right, right. And the drum shop was owned by Mickey's father.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then one other thing, to something Jim said earlier, as far as solo acoustic, I think April 10th, 1982, I think from Passaic, New Jersey, is one of the only times that Garcia was playing solo acoustic, or yeah, playing a solo show. And there's actually an amazing video of that. So if you actually go to YouTube and Google it, you can find it. And getting to see Garcia play Rubin and Charisse solo is pretty unbelievable. So definitely check that out. I think it's April 10th, 1982 from Passaic, New Jersey.
Okay, I'm writing that down because I don't want to forget that. I'm going to have something to listen to on the way home. If not,
yeah, I'll send you a link after we get off the air. But it's definitely worth checking out. So
yeah, and so if anybody just ever wants to know why we love to have a guy with about six levels of dead nerdiness on, now you know why, because that's where all the great little nuggets lie. And if you want to find him, you have to know where to look for him. So hats off to Rob for that little piece, and Jim for his knowledge as well. Just like David Gans was telling us, every time we get on and start talking about this, there's always something new to learn. And that's what makes it fun. At the end of the day, it was great to have Mickey in the band. We all know he took a few years off. We've talked about that on earlier episodes. But there's no denying that, he and what he brought to the band in a percussion way really sealed the deal. Actually, just a quick little story here before we go in that regard. For the for Yom Kippur this year, the group that my wife and I belong to, that's kind of an informal, not really quite a synagogue, but our own little group that we go to, one of the guys who leads the services has really wonderful eclectic music taste that tends to run more towards the far east. And at one of the moments, he introduced a prayer to kind of a Sufi musical beat, drum beat. And as I was listening to it, the thought that immediately came to mind was Hamza al-Din and Alan Aga Reed from the Egypt shows. So I went back and found those shows and shared them with him, and he and I had an opportunity to discuss that. And, as Mickey would say, this is all about living on, the planet drum, and, everything in our lives is acoustical, and it's just a matter of stopping and listening to it and appreciating it. So hats off to Mickey, and hats off to Billy for having the foresight to invite him in the band 54 years ago.
No doubt.
Well, gentlemen, I think we've run out of time and run out of information for the moment, at least. So any final thoughts, Jim?
No, great show. Great talking to you guys, as usual. And like I said, really enjoyed those Phil shows, and you're going to have a wonderful time at the Capitol.
My first time. I'm still waiting for our resident Capitol Theater expert to give me all the pointers I need to get around out there without hurting myself or anything.
I'll continue to debrief you as we get closer to the date, Larry. Absolutely. So as my sign off today, before we give you a little outro of a Broke Down Palace from that October 3rd show from the Warfield as well, just quickly want to say thank you to everyone out there that's been listening. We actually do follow the analytics of, how many people are actually tuning in to hear us. And we've been unbelievably lucky over the last, year or 2 years that we've been doing this show to have some terrific guests and terrific people to share the stage with and talk with. But, it's really, really nice and humbling for us to know that there's actually people out there listening. And so to all of you that are taking the time to listen to our show and tell your friends about our show, thank you. And thanks so much for tuning in and spending time with us when you've got some extra time yourself. But it is truly humbling for us to know that we've got an audience out there. So thank you very much.
Yeah, I would have to agree with Rob on that. I'm just excited that anybody listens to me. So, it's wonderful to have an audience. It's great that there are people out there who, find what we say interesting enough, and we try to keep it that way. So absolutely, thank you for listening.
All right. Well, I think I'm about done. I'm ready to say over and out.
Okay. And then I will say over and out to everyone. Thank you again for joining us. Next week, our guest is Stu Sallow, who we have had on the show before. Stu is from the Boulder, Colorado area. He's a biking enthusiast, a Grateful Dead enthusiast, and always has lots of fun stories to share with us. So we will look forward to speaking with him. In the meantime, everybody, have a great week. Stay safe and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thank you.